Stanley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Midterm elections are often perilous for the party that holds the White House, and this year that could be the case, with Democrats in Congress defending more seats than Republicans and voters said to be in an uncertain mood over the economy, the Affordable Care Act, and foreign policy as tensions rise with Russia. Here in New Hampshire, midterm elections have produced recent waves in our legislature. Democrats were swept in 2006, only to be swept out by Republicans in 2010. This year, the state, House and Senate, are anyone's guess, but recent polls indicate it could be a rocky ride for the state's two Democratic members of Congress, Carol Shea Porter and Anne McClain Custer. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen seems to face less trouble at this point, but that could change if former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown jumps in. Today in The Exchange, it's an early bird preview of the midterm elections, the candidates, the themes, and the outside big money forces that might get involved in New Hampshire's races. Let's hear from you. What campaigns or what big ideas are you watching as preparations for these elections begins? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. With us in studio, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Josh, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dante Scala, associate professor of political science at UNH and a fellow at UNH's Carsey Institute. And Dante, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Ben Tafoya, assistant professor of political science at New England College. He also directs the NEC poll. And Ben, good to have you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
And I want to start with you, Dante, but hear from everybody. Just a little more, Dante, if you could, please, on the character of a midterm election. These are very different from those big presidential year elections.
Right. The big difference between midterms and presidential elections is turnout. Turnout is significantly lower in midterm elections than in general elections. And in recent years, we've seen one party or the other gain the advantage of that turnout. So it's not just lower turnout, but it appears as if there's a turnout differential between, say, one partisan group, the Democrats, and the other partisan group, the Republicans. And we've seen that recently in New Hampshire, for example. I mean, if you date back to 2006, a bad year for Republicans, George W. Bush, very low in approval numbers, and Democrats have a huge year in 2006, win just about everything in sight. 2008, Obama wins New Hampshire. 2010, everyone's talking about New Hampshire being a blue state, no longer a red state. 2010, bang. I mean, Republicans win virtually everything in sight, obliterate the Democrats up and down the ticket.
Except for the governor's office.
Except John Lynch, right, the lone holdout and all that. And he had a much closer race than he had had in previous elections. So what we see in these midterms is, at least in New Hampshire, pretty wild swings. But it all goes back to this kind of big national global question of who's going to turn out to vote. And typically in these elections, you see the president's party, whichever party has the president in the White House, tends to suffer, especially in the midpoint of the second term, which Obama, of course, is approaching now.
Yeah, it's almost become a truism, Dante, right? I mean, this is pretty rare that a president doesn't suffer in the second midterm of his second term.
Yeah. I mean, you can go back to, say, Bill Clinton in 1998. He actually, he and his party did surprisingly well, but it was true for George Bush in 2006. And so far, at least heading into 2014, it appears that while it's too early to say whether there's going to be a wave election or not, Democrats are certainly very cautious going into this midterm election.
Josh Rogers, redistricting happened in 2010, and then we had a general election in 2012. Is that going to affect this year's midterm elections? And what other factors do you see at play in these midterms?
Well, it's not likely to affect the congressional races, but certainly the trickle-down effect to the state house in a certainly the redistricting plans put forth in 2010 were designed by Republicans to serve Republican interests. Particularly the House's plan was controversial. And the 2012 turnout arguably, you know, sort of obliterated the implications of that. But in a low turnout race where At least now it looks like Republicans are going to have an easier chance of motivating their base. It'll be interesting to see what the implications are in the New Hampshire House in particular, and you know also to some degree in the Senate. The redistricting map put forth there probably helped the Republicans maintain control in 2012. You know, they now have a two-seat cushion. Dante set it up well. Certainly, in the second term, midterm is tough. Obviously, President Obama is facing challenges with his signature domestic policy, the Affordable Care Act, and what happens internationally could have an effect on these elections. But we're still 9 months away, so we don't really know what's going to happen. And in some of the major races, Republicans don't really have candidates that are seen as terribly viable. Certainly, the U.S. Senate race, it'll be interesting to see what sort of challenge the present field can mount against Gene Shaheen, and certainly in the corner office, Andrew Hemingway is an energetic fellow, but he's yet to galvanize the Republican Party.
All right. And we'll definitely dig into that U.S. Senate race in just a minute. But Ben Tafoy, I also wanted to get your thoughts just on the character of midterms. You've written about this, looking at past midterms over the past few decades.
Yeah. So if we take a look at the last 20 times there was a midterm election, elections between the presidential year where Congress and some percentage of the Senate was up for grabs, the president's party has lost an average of 27.8 seats, roughly 28 seats each time.
It's a lot of seats.
It is. But to Dante's point, there's a wide range, right? So in President Obama's first term, the Democrats lost over 60 seats in 2010. They recovered some of those back, last time. It's not entirely clear on the House side how far they have to go down. There are several dozen seats that independent observers have pinned as being competitive going into this year. But it's highly unlikely we would see as big a wave hit the president's party in 2014 as hit it in 2010.
The shellacking that Obama talked about.
Right. Except on the Senate side, which is in Democratic hands. And because of the nature of the waves in the past, you get sort of a skewed number of seats that one party or the other has to defend on the Senate. And the Democrats currently, with the two independents, have a 55-45 advantage in the U.S. Senate. But they have to defend 21 seats in this election. Republicans have 15. That's because there are three extra seats this time because of special elections, basically to fulfill the end of someone else's term.
I see what you're saying. So when we have these waves, so to speak, that's great for the party that benefits from the wave. But then 6 years later,
exactly,
they face a lot of vulnerability in the U.S. Senate.
That's correct.
So, for example, in 2016, Kelly Ayotte, who was elected in 2000, is going to face a tough time. Jean Shaheen this time around, we'll talk about her in just a minute. But that's a really interesting observation. Dante, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I guess to build on Ben's good point, in the Senate, Democratic senators, seven of them, are running in states that Mitt Romney carried 2 years ago.
Okay, so they're in a tough position.
So as Ben said, there are a lot of Democratic senators who are basically in enemy territory at this point who are trying to defend their seats. But on the House side, a lot of that has been flushed out already. I mean, Republicans already have an advantage of 30-odd seats in the House of Representatives. So there are relatively few seats in which, you know, a Democrat is holding a seat where Obama did worse than he did nationally. But one of those seats is New Hampshire's 1st District, which Carol Shea Porter is trying to defend. Shea Porter's seat is one of the top, say, 15 in the country among House races. And Ann Custer in the 2nd District is probably one of the top three dozen seats in the country.
And when you say top, Dante, what do you mean exactly? That the observers are watching, like the Cook Political Report and so forth?
Yeah, I would say in top as in one of potentially one of the most competitive seats in the country.
Our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we bring you a early bird preview of the 2014 midterm elections. We're looking at some of the big themes, the big issues, and the candidates here in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Josh, you mentioned the U.S. Senate race, and let's look a little bit at that. Again, it's been said, as our guests have said, the U.S. Senate is a big prize this time around. Gene Shaheen, though, at this point, looking pretty secure?
Well, I mean, the polls indicate that you know, she's in a reasonable place. She's proven herself to be a durable politician. The only time she's lost running in New Hampshire in her many elections was in 2002, which was a big year for Republicans, and also coming after she had served three terms as governor. So there was, you know, a bit of fatigue, a factor. It's, you know, once you get to the Senate, you're not in people's face as much. And, you know, people, you know, Shaheen is generally well regarded. The Affordable Care Act is tougher for all Democrats. You know, Gene Shaheen's voting record is pretty much in lockstep with the president, which is, you know, not uncommon for members of Congress to be in lockstep with the president of their own party. You know, she's hard campaigner, tough to beat. Obviously, she's – I don't know how many fundraising emails she sent out about Scott Brown, several dozen at this point.
Really? But he's not even in the race
yet. He's
not
in the race. I mean, he's the best way for her to raise money. You know, Jim Rubens was a state senator, ran for governor, hard to pigeonhole as a Republican, you know, believes climate change has man-made components, is pro-choice, worked as a private investor, interesting background.
Former state senator,
yes,
ran for governor
before. You know, he's been out there and running hard, but, you know, he's not somebody that he's not a central casting for Republicans, nor is Karen Testerman, who's, you know, staunch social conservative, run for a number of things, never been elected.
She's also tried for governor before.
She's also tried for governor. Bob Smith, of course, is back. He announced last week. You know, he lost a seat in 2002 in the primary to John Sununu the Younger. Is, you know, Bob Smith is in his 70s, moved back from Florida. You know, he's had a difficult relationship with his own party, you know, famously left it, you know, gave a fiery speech on the Senate floor, had some aborted runs for Senate in Florida, you know, was back up here somewhat on the ill-fated Gingrich presidential campaign. You know, interesting guy, might be able to galvanize some social conservatives. But again, I've yet to talk to many Republicans who believe that he's going to face it. He's going to be a huge challenge to Gene Shaheen if he gets through the primary.
More on the U.S. Senate race in just a moment. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Day one of NHPR's March Fund Drive is Wednesday. We're planning to raise the entire day's goal in just 4 hours. Your donation now counts towards the tally and helps us collect $10,000 in challenge money. Pay for the new service you rely on at nhpr.org or with a phone call to 1-888-805-6477. And thanks. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank. Trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs, themerrimack.com. From Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health, 13 locations statewide, information at d-hdocs.org. And from Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, seeking solutions that work and creating sustainable communities where nothing goes to waste, not a shirt, not a shoe, not a person. GoodwillNNE.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an early bird preview of the midterm elections of 2014. We're looking at the candidates here in New Hampshire, some of the themes that we're hearing about in these races, and later on we'll look at some of the outside big money forces that might get involved in New Hampshire's races. Let's hear from you two this hour. What campaigns are you watching? What big ideas do you think will play a role this time around as preparations for these elections heats up? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Josh Rogers is here, NHPR senior political reporter, along with Dante Scala of UNH and Ben Tafoya of New England College. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Ben's calling from Tilton. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
My question is basically for all your guests. I want to know where Scott Brown stands in being in the race or not in the race. And is the fact that he's not truly a New Hampshire resident factoring into that at all?
This is a great question, Ben. Yeah, thank you very much. Dante, he asks a great question that a lot of people are asking.
Right. Well, first, I believe he is a New Hampshire resident now. That's settled.
And he sold his home in Massachusetts. Right, living in Rye.
Exactly. And so, but the bigger question is, you know, will he enter the race or not? And we're still, you know, 3 months ahead of the filing deadline in mid-June. We're still waiting to hear. There's lots of stories that are circulating. Recently, there was a breaking news that he had discussed the issue of entering the race with his family on some sort of trip or vacation. There were rumors that he's talking to operatives in New Hampshire about putting together a staff. But the bottom line is, until he actually enters the race, signs the papers, and so forth, we just don't know.
And so why not? That's the other question that Ben asks. And Ben Tafoya, I'll go to you on that, and Josh, I want to hear from you too.
Well, you know, Scott Brown has also spent some time going around the country. The thing that I watched in 2013 was that he made trips to Iowa in addition to New Hampshire. And that sort of indicates an interest perhaps in a different level of political involvement.
A presidential run.
Right. So if he was poking around on that, and if he just, you know, decided that it wasn't the right time for that, a shift to the Senate race in New Hampshire doesn't seem, unreasonable. In his two campaigns in Massachusetts for the U.S. Senate, he raised a tremendous amount of money, and he has access to, the big dollar sources, and there are a lot of folks who came in on his behalf. With the outside groups that he could probably depend on fairly reliably should even at a late date decide to make a run here in New Hampshire.
What kind of outside money groups are interested in a Scott Brown?
Well, he had support from the main funders of this this kind of activity. So the Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers kind of efforts. There was a little video that got some viral play in Massachusetts in early in the 2012 race, where he was talking to the Koch brothers at a fundraising event, asking for their help in that Senate race.
Josh?
Well, I mean, Scott Brown, he's been the odd thing publicly is that he's been saying he's been thinking about this for now, close to a year. And, it does beg the question at a certain point, how long does it take you to make up your mind? He does still have some time. He can certainly raise money. He is going to be in New Hampshire this weekend at an event that the Republican Party is having. He's going to be sitting at a table with some of the two of the people who were in these American for Prosperity advertisements attacking the Affordable Care Act. A lot of people are going to be watching. He does live in Rye. He, anytime Cheap Trick is playing at the Hampton Casino, he is there. I know that they're scheduled for May. He's somebody that does, bring a national profile to this race. The Shaheen people have used that to raise money. Though when Scott Brown appeared at the Republican Party holiday party, he also, brought out people who were concerned about some of his positions, which may fly as being a Republican from Massachusetts, i.e. on guns, that aren't going to be terribly popular with Republican activists here.
And he's seen as more of a moderate Republican, right, Josh?
Yeah, well, that's definitely, and that that is something that, is more of a necessity in Massachusetts than it is here. And, he may say, and he may have roots in New Hampshire that go back 12 generations. But, until he gets in the race and, actually circulates among voters here as a candidate, it's really hard to know how he'll go over. But it's been strange.
Yeah. So right now it's been more these big high profile events, not so much going out to the country store and shaking hands, Josh, and really connecting with the people.
Well, I mean, he's not running.
Right.
I mean, so it's hard to know. And certainly he hasn't made the traditional overtures. I mean, people say, oh, he's calling the Senate president, he's calling the Republican leader in the House, and he's reached out to some people. But, you know, maybe he doesn't have to do it the traditional way, but he hasn't thus far. And so everybody's still watching, though. So he's got that going for him or against him.
Dante, real quick, and then back to our callers.
Yeah, there are two schools of thought about when Scott Brown needs to enter the race. Traditionally, these things take time, or so they say. It takes time to build an organization, takes time to build national or state name recognition, takes time to raise money. New school of thought would be, in this day and age of super PACs, it doesn't take much time to raise money because outside groups will spend millions of dollars on Scott Brown's behalf without his having to go out and raise a dime. He already has a significant amount of name recognition, especially in the Massachusetts border. And the longer he stays on the sidelines, let's say he gets in to the race on June 12th, well, that's all the less time that his competition for the Republican nomination, that's the less time they have to go after him over the months.
That's a really interesting point. So it may be actually better for him to enter late because the other candidates in this race will have less time to hone their talking points against him in the primary.
This is also a candidate whose biggest success politically was in a special election, a sort of a tightened sort of time frame where there was a big, you know, lots of momentum. And,
Ted Kennedy died.
And he rode it. And, maybe that's a possibility for him here in New Hampshire.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us with your questions, comments, thoughts on the 2014 midterm elections. We're talking about the U.S. Senate race. And in a few minutes, we'll turn our attention to the two congressional races. Lots of interesting activity there as well. The number 1-800-892-6477. Scott's calling from Dover. Scott, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I think a lot of folks, independents and Republicans in New Hampshire have not been happy with Jeanne Shaheen, both with Obamacare and, you know, maybe thinking that she's put the interests of the Democratic Party before the interests of New Hampshire. But I would say that, I guess maybe this would be a warning to the Republican Party in New Hampshire that if Scott Brown runs, I think that would be a major mistake. People from Massachusetts have a certain reputation here in New Hampshire and not really a positive one, which I think is well-earned. But, I think a lot of people would consider him a carpetbagger, don't support his policies. You know, I'm an independent, and, I voted for Jeanne Shaheen and for Barack Obama for one term, but I definitely would not support anyone from Massachusetts here. And I think a lot of people, if he turned out to be the candidate and ran, I think it would just be giving it to Jeanne Shaheen. I think it would be a major mistake.
Okay. Well, good to hear from you, Scott. Thank you very much. And Ben, what do you think? Scott says a lot of Republicans and independents are not happy with so-called Obamacare, but they don't like the carpetbagger issue as well.
Well, there are some well-known instances of folks who were able to either just sort of randomly pick a state to run for the U.S. Senate in, and because of their notoriety, we're able to carry that off. New York, has two well-known instances in history, Hillary Clinton in 2000 and Robert Kennedy back in the early 1960s.
So this has been done before.
So it has been done before. We're talking about Scott Brown today. So obviously, he to the extent that he wants to get some buzz, he's been getting it. But if we look sort of more seriously about Jeanne Shaheen's position, we did a poll. The last time we asked the question was back in October, and she at that point had very strong approval ratings in New Hampshire. And if I was Scott Brown, this is one of the things that I would take a long, hard look at is overall Jeanne Shaheen had an approval rating of 56%, obviously much higher among Democrats. Her approval rating among Republicans was only 23%, and The unenrolled independent folks are in the middle there.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Scott. And again, you can join us with your comments, questions about the candidates and the issues of the 2014 midterm elections, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. Post a comment there. Gentlemen, I did want to pick up on something else that Scott said. He said, you know, as an independent, he said he's not happy with the Affordable Care Act. How do you, Dante Scala, see the ACA playing out in these midterm elections? How Republicans are handling it? How Democrats are handling it? Let's talk about Democrats first, Dante.
There's another race going on tomorrow outside of New Hampshire down in Florida. There's a special congressional election in Florida's 13th district. And outside money has poured into this district from both sides. And that is seen by both parties as a test case for the healthcare message going in November. On the Republican side, you know, it's the message we've been hearing, kind of negative message about Obamacare, hammering the Democrats. On the Democratic side, the attempt is to tell the message of don't end it, but fix it. You know, an openness to fixing Obamacare going forward. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, after tomorrow night, what lessons both parties take, whether Democrats think they can go forward and basically say, yes, there are some problems with Obamacare, but we don't want to go back to the way things were, you know, when, you know, people weren't covered if they had pre-existing conditions, et cetera. Or if Republicans take from tomorrow's election, look, we can use Obamacare to hammer the Democrats for the next 8 months. So a lot, you know, we don't know yet whether healthcare would be the issue going forward. If it is, it's certainly, almost certainly, going to be a very bad night for Democrats if all we're talking about in November is Obamacare.
Well, Josh, are we hearing that same slogan on each side here in New Hampshire? You know, fix it on the Democratic side and get rid of it on the Republican side.
Sure. And it's interesting to the extent, you know, there were some votes last week in Congress. Both Representatives Shea Porter and Custer voted for a Republican-backed bill that would delay the individual mandate for another year. This is something that they both opposed in the past. And, you know, their arguments on their behalf now are that, you know, this sort of a fix-it argument. Carol Shea Porter says, oh, well, you know, we wouldn't have anticipated that we would have one carrier on the exchange, and the network that Anthem designed is so narrow that, you know, we want to give people choices. So it's only fair that we, you know, hold back a year. You know, there's also the argument that, you know, there's been a delay of the mandate for the small business groups. We need parity up and down the policy. You know, there's no doubt that this is politically sensitive. And, you know, there's been reporting that shows the degree to which the you know, White House political wing has been in touch with people in vulnerable seats, and, you know, people, the reporting shows that, you know, that Shea Porter, Custer, and Shaheen were all you know, contacted on you know, another change which would allow substandard policies to be re-upped again, which would push the you know, the flow of renewal notices or policy cancellation notices out past Election Day. And so, you know, there's certainly an effort to sort of triage the effects, you know, until after the election. I mean, what's interesting is the way in which during the, you know, by contrast around the State House during the debate over Medicaid expansion and some of the bills looking at the network that Anthem set up at the State House level, is you have Democrats there saying, oh, well, you know, this is, you know, it's not perfect, but it's still all working sort of according to plan. And, you know, Obamacare envisioned these narrow networks because it would keep down costs. And so it is interesting that disjunction between the way you hear Republicans, I mean, Democrats talking about this in the New Hampshire State House, and which is largely, you know, defending it, and the way in which they're choosing to talk about it on the national level, which is, you know, sort of defending it, but sort of I'm going to keep my distance from this as well.
Interesting. And even though this hour we're mainly focusing on the midterm elections, I do wonder, Josh, how Republicans running for the U.S. Senate, for Congress, are going to critique the Affordable Care Act when Republicans in the legislature have recently approved a major portion of the Affordable Care Act, which is Medicaid expansion. So, you know, when, for example, Marilinda Garcia in the second district, or Frank Ginta in the first district, critiques Obamacare, so-called Obamacare, will they, by extension, be critiquing the leaders of the New Hampshire Senate who recently approved Medicaid expansion?
It is interesting. I mean, you know, consistency is never a necessity in political campaigns. I mean, certainly, like, you're just going to kind of go for what works. And obviously, you know, we will see. I mean, Democrats would have you believe that some of the wind is going to be out of the, you know, Obamacare is horrendous argument come November. We don't know that yet. But right now, Republicans are loaded for bear on that front.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at some of the key issues and some of the key races in New Hampshire's 2014 elections. Among those issues, the Affordable Care Act. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in from Christopher in Manchester. He says, how competitive do your guests think that the Republican first congressional district race will be? Christopher asks, does Dan Innes stand a chance against Frank Ginta? Will we see any other candidates entering that primary? Christopher, thanks for the email. It's a great question. And Ben, I did want to talk about the first congressional district. Carol Shea Porter, the Democratic incumbent. Let's talk about the Republicans in that race.
Well, one interesting fact I stumbled across thinking about a conversation this morning is that apparently in 20% of the congressional races in New Hampshire since the founding of the Republican Party in the 1850s have involved one type of rematch or another. So the idea that we would be seeing the third round between Frank Ginta and Carol Shea Porter, I guess, is not that unique in New Hampshire political history. But, you know, there are other candidates in the first CD race. The candidate that, on the Republican side I'm more familiar with would be Dan Innes. You know, on paper, he has a great profile for somebody who would be looking to run a competitive race for Congress. Former dean, somebody who has good ties to the business community in the state, and you know, someone who's openly gay. So, you know, you have certain kinds of very interesting characteristics, but you know, he's up against in the primary Frank Ginta, former mayor of Manchester, who was a member of Congress, you know, for 2 years. And
he's run these campaigns before.
He's run it before. He has access to money, et cetera. It's very difficult to go from little name recognition to sufficient in order to overcome that kind of advantage.
Dante, I've been covering New Hampshire politics for a long time. This is the first time I remember an openly gay candidate running for major office here in the Granite State. What effect, if any, does that have?
Same here. I mean, I agree. I have the same memories you do of this. And, well, I think what will be interesting to see is how much this issue plays out and whether Republicans, you know, who are going to be voting in a September primary are thinking we need to expand our base. We need to bring in under the big tent a socially moderate, fiscally conservative type of candidate, because that's how Dan Innes is trying to set himself up versus Frank Ginta. Now, the dilemma there is in a September primary, which is going to be low turnout, you're going to get the most conservative, most ideological voters turning out to vote. And so the question will that subgroup of Republicans be interested in a Dan Innes candidacy?
All right, Josh, I'll get your thoughts in just a moment. More conversation about the 2014 midterm elections coming up and more of your calls and emails, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
You're economical with your time, and you listen to NHPR because it lets you do other things while you catch up on the news. We're economical with your time, too, and only do as much fundraising as we need to keep the programs you love going. That's why we're planning to raise our entire day's fundraising goal for day one of our March drive in just 4 hours. When we hear from 350 people, we'll cancel the drive for the rest of the day and collect $10,000 in challenge money. Your contribution now helps at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from, you are listeners, and from Birchill Terrace, a not-for-profit continuing care retirement community offering independent living, assisted living, and nursing care in Manchester. BirchillTerrace.com. And Landmark College, Putney, Vermont, offering a summer institute for education professionals working with students who learn differently. June 24th to 27th. Information at landmark.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an early bird preview of New Hampshire's 2014 midterm elections. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. What races are you watching in particular? What candidates are you paying attention to? And what are some of the big ideas that you think might affect this year's midterms? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. And Josh Rogers, just before the break, we were talking about Christopher's email asking about the race between two Republicans in the first congressional district, Dan Innes, the former UNH Business School dean, and Frank Ginta, former Manchester mayor, former congressman from the district. I'd love your thoughts there, too. How competitive a race do you see this?
Well, we'll see. I mean, obviously, Ginta starts with a name recognition advantage. You know, the primaries haven't really gotten going and going in terms of actual, you know, candidates engaging each other much. One interesting thing going for Dan Innes is the announcement that Peter Paul, who, you know, funded the business school that Dan Innes was dean of, is, you know, going to essentially have a super PAC working on Dan Innes's behalf and is, you know, apparently said he's willing to spend $500,000, which is not an insignificant amount of money, in order to help somebody, you know, introduce himself to the voters. And, you know, that may be a help. You know, it may not be. But, you know, Dan Innes is an interesting figure. He, you know, he's been issuing papers on various issues. Not that anyone's been paying much attention to them, but, I mean, they're there if you want to read them. And, you know, his background is as a marketing expert. And so, you know, this will be an interesting challenge for him.
Yeah, he's bringing that business sensibility to the race. Again, I want to take our listeners' questions and comments about the 2014 midterms. We're looking at U.S. Senate, 1st Congressional District. In just a minute, we'll take a look at the 2nd Congressional District. Right now, though, a call from Pat in Chichester. Go ahead, Pat. Good to hear from you. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess one of my concerns for all the races, but especially as I look at the Senate, is that there aren't in the candidates that most people are really talking about, there's not really a big choice. The funding is pretty much the same. Obviously, there's the super PACs with the Democrats and the Republicans being different, but the other big donors tend to be the same, and the issues tend to be the same. And when it comes to the Senator Shaheen's current seat right now, I really think the only candidate stands out that's significantly different is Karen Testerman. And if you look back at her records, she's been consistent for veterans, personal liberty, and for the conservative side, whereas the other candidates have really been consistently similar on lots of things, basically voting for the money that supports them.
What about, so I hear you saying that, you know, Karen Testerman, you feel, is the only strong conservative in this race, Pat. What about Bob Smith?
Bob Smith has been voting where the money is. And we know he has sort of gone off on a lot of, I think, what's important for Bob Smith. He's that I appreciate where he stood on a few, on many of the conservative issues, but if you really look at that, it's much more of a personal thing, his I guess, you know, a lot like Senator Shaheen, what is good for his name?
Okay.
And I have a problem with his integrity, and definitely with Senator Shaheen's integrity.
Pat, thank you very much for calling in. Dante, what do you think?
Well, it could be a very interesting primary if things break the right way, and by that I mean, you know, if Scott Brown gets into the race. And if one of these more conservative candidates, either Smith or Testerman, is able to raise enough money to really engage with Scott Brown, then you might have a debate about issues. Even if Scott Brown doesn't get in the race, well, what happens then? Then you have three candidates, Bob Smith, Karen Testerman, both, you know, on the very conservative wing of the party, both potentially appealing to Tea Partiers. But then on the other side, you have Jim Rubins, right, the former state senator, who takes some positions on issues that are definitely at odds with kind of the reigning conservative ideology.
He's
on issues.
He's the fiscally liberal, fiscally conservative, socially liberal.
Yeah,
Jim
and
Rubins.
Also on the environment takes, as Josh mentioned, some positions at variance. So potentially there is room for kind of a debate within the party on issues. So I think that might satisfy what Pat's looking for.
Ben?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the Republicans are going to be rather sensitive to is trying, because they have a shot at getting a majority in the Senate, is making sure that the candidates who come forward out of their primaries are people that are going to be competitive in the general election. And the minority leader
may be up for grabs, as you said.
Minority leader from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, has basically declared that no Tea Party candidate is going to emerge out of the primaries. So he's got a challenge.
Hopefully not his.
He's got his own, and there are
okay. I missed that. When did he say that? That's really interesting.
Just late last week. So.
And what does that mean? I know we need to talk about the second district, but what does that mean for Frank Ginta in the first district? He, in 2010, was identified more with the Tea Party.
Well, he was making that claim about U.S. Senate races. That's kind of his concern is the Senate as opposed to the House.
Josh, we do need to talk about the second congressional district. Pat in Chichester, thank you for that call. Just lay out for us, if you could, Josh, the candidates, the themes of the second congressional district. We've got Ann McLean Custer, who's the Democratic incumbent.
Well, we have Ann McLean Custer, who's a Democratic incumbent, and she, that second CD is, tilts a little bit more Democratic than the first CD does. And so, that serves her reasonably well on the Republican side. I mean, but she's still, vulnerable in the polls, as Dante mentioned. I mean, she's somebody that seat could flip. On the Republican side, you have a primary between Marilinda Garcia, who's a current member of the New Hampshire House. She's been in for a number of terms. She's young. She's been seen as a rising star within the Republican Party. She's Latin background, well-educated, professional harpist, has, worked, she says, as a cybersecurity consultant, very conservative, spoke at CPAC over the weekend. And you have Gary Lambert, who was a state senator, former Marine, patent lawyer, elected in 2010. Energetic, wasn't around long enough in Concord to cut too big a figure. They haven't really engaged much yet. It's still early. There's been a little back and forth about, who endorsed whom when at the local level. But this is an interesting race to watch. Marilinda Garcia, as I said, has been promoted naturally within the party and potentially is in a position to raise some reasonable money. She hasn't been a huge presence at the State House either. She's been there for a while and is, well-regarded among conservatives. Never sponsored any huge bills of consequence. The biggest piece of legislation she was involved in was one that failed, was intending to create a carve-out of state law for destination hospitals. It was the Cancer Treatment Centers of America. It was quite controversial. It was an effort to exempt them from the state's Medicaid taxes and also the Certificate of Need process. The Cancer Treatment Centers of America founder Richard Stevenson is a big backer of FreedomWorks, a very conservative fellow. Garcia's campaign consultants are affiliated with Americans for Prosperity. It's interesting. Again, we haven't really seen them engage. And until you really see people out on the campaign trail, it's hard to know, how well they translate. On paper, she's, a strong candidate, perhaps a bit more conservative than people who have tended to get elected out of the CD. I mean, I guess you'd have to think back to Chuck Douglas to think about somebody who really ran and got elected as a conservative there.
They've had a long history
Gary
of moderate
Lambert,
Democrats and moderate Republicans.
Gary Lambert is energetic. This is a race that's hard to pick at this point, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, well, it is interesting to watch, especially since, as Josh mentioned, Marilinda Garcia is seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, got an official sort of rising star award a couple months back, Dante, and helping Republicans with that demographic problem.
Yeah, and one question will be whether, in the end, the money will be there for Garcia to run a competitive primary and then move into the general election. I think that'll, will conservatives in the party kind of put their money where their mouth is and support this quote-unquote rising star? And then if you get to the general election, I mean, the question will be, will it be about the ideology of the candidates or will it be really about the incumbent? And that's a troubling question for Ann McLean Custer. On the one hand, she's sitting, because she's an incumbent in part, she's sitting on $1 million cash on hand right now. So she has a huge advantage going into the calendar year. But on the other hand, of the three Democrats we've talked about, Shaheen, Shea Porter, and Custer, she's the least known in New Hampshire. She's the least liked in New Hampshire. I mean, her unfavorables outweigh her favorables, according to my colleague Andy Smith's Granite State poll. And so there's this turnout differential problem. You know, who's going to turn out to vote if it's a year that's bad for President Obama? You know, if his numbers stay in the low 40s in New Hampshire, that could translate over to someone who's a not well-known Democrat to her detriment.
Yeah, getting back to our earlier conversation about the character of midterms and who turns out and who doesn't. Ben, real quick to you and then back to our listeners.
Yeah, to Dante's point, it was about 120,000 people less voted at the congressional race level in 2010 in each of the congressional districts than did in 2012.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and it means that the voter universe you're talking to is totally different in a midterm than in the presidential year.
Let's take another call. This is Mary waiting in Tamworth. Mary, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to say back to Obamacare that I think that the Obamacare program is now in a stealthy way winning people over right and left in our town. People are telling success stories to each other about lowered premiums, lowered deductibles, and we just had one fellow have a very serious operation. He couldn't have afforded on his carotid artery, saved his life, and that was because of Obamacare that he could go so fast he could afford it. And it's even happening, it's creeping into the Republican population, the right-wingers, and the word is getting out. And I think this is going to affect the election because I think people are going to understand that as much as they didn't like the rollout and as much as they identify with their parties, they actually do like this program.
Mary, yeah, thanks for calling in. And one of you mentioned, maybe it was you, Dante, that certainly the White House is hoping that things will fix themselves, get a little easier over the next 8 months, and that this will turn out to be a plus. So we'll see. Mary's hoping it will be.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. I mean, one thing we've seen in polling on this new health care law has been remarkably steady. And what's remarkably steady is that only a minority support the law. Now, you can argue about whether some of those opponents say Obamacare didn't go far enough. You know, those would be liberals who would say we should have single-payer health care and so forth. A key question, though, going into November is, will Obamacare be one issue or will it be the issue? And there are signs that perhaps the worst is over for Democrats. I mean, with the Obamacare rollout, you saw Democrats plunge in terms of, you know, would you rather vote for a Democrat or a Republican in Congress this year? And now numbers have rebounded. Democrats have a small advantage over Republicans on the so-called generic congressional ballot.
You know, go ahead, Ben and Josh. Yeah.
Sure. And again, to Dante's point, the White House and congressional Democrats do have some issues that they want to bring to people's attention during this cycle that would change the narrative and potentially the dynamic in critical places that will, in the end, sort of decide this thing. Issues like immigration, the minimum wage, the economy in general, economic inequality, et cetera. Those would be the kinds of things that you should expect to hear quite a bit from Democrats during the campaign.
Go ahead, Josh.
Well, I mean, to Ben's point, we'll be hearing some of that. I mean, there's bills moving through the legislature on, you know, sort of pay equity and the minimum wage that, you know, will help potentially get those issues in the mind of the general public. I mean, one interesting thing about, you know, Obamacare is that you talk about the rate of people who are insured right now in New Hampshire is already so high that, you know, it's interesting. I'd be curious to know what you guys think about just in terms of the raw numbers. I mean, you think about even at the high end, you think 22,000 notices went out saying that, you know, insurance policies were changing or being canceled. Some of those notices would have gone out anyway. That's a big number. But, you know, we're still talking about a state where, you know, we've got a lot more voters than that. And the viral effect of, you know, bad news is, you know, something to think about. But, you know, the rate of insureds in New Hampshire is high. And so while this is something that everybody's talking about, the number of people who are complaining the loudest about it are often not people who are affected by it. And so, you know, this is something that I've been puzzling over. And I don't know whether, you know, there's anything with those with a more sort of scientific bent to their politics have anything to say about it.
Dante, you want to jump in? And then I've got another question for you guys.
I suspect that Ann Custer and Carol Shea Porter would be happy simply to neutralize the issue to some degree. And I think you're right. I mean, the fact is that for most New Hampshire residents, Obamacare hasn't made much difference to their particular health insurance situation. And so there's been all this bad news out there about Obamacare, especially with the rollout. And that's been something that both Custer and Shea Porter and Shaheen as well have had to address. Will the good news outweigh the bad news over the next several months? It may help dissipate it somewhat, but I'm hard-pressed to see it being a net positive for Democrats going into November.
Well, whatever narrative gets out there, partly Bentifoia will be due to the fact that there'll be big money groups playing a role, putting their messages out. How big do you think big money will be this time around, and what kind of big money?
Well, if I had a chance, I'd buy a television station in New Hampshire because their business will be going through the roof, assuming that these races are as competitive as we're talking about them being today. There's an extraordinary amount of money being spent by outside groups on political campaigns. Again, with the Senate being up for grabs, this year is a possible changeover from Dems to Republicans. There'll be a lot. In the literature, however, it's still not entirely clear that the money makes difference in the outcome.
We talked about that actually in 2012.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, again, we have sort of another test case where the money will be bigger than it was certainly in 2010. And does it really, make that much of a difference to the outcome?
All right. Well, that's a subject we will definitely be following up on as this 2014 season heats up. Here's one last email that I want to throw out there. Came from someone who didn't give a name. Any possibility of John Lynch as a Senate candidate in 2016? Anyone want to tackle that? Ben.
The only thing I would say is that we actually did poll approval numbers for John Lynch before he left office, and they were extraordinarily high in New Hampshire, 70% plus approval ratings. If he should make a comeback, he is a good base to start from.
Dante and Josh?
John Lynch loved being governor of New Hampshire. He never showed any appetite for going to D.C. and becoming a senator.
That was the sense I got from him as well, and I asked him on multiple occasions when he was governor. Josh, you want to jump in?
He always said no.
All right, we'll leave it at that, a Sherman-esque statement. Thank you all very much for coming in. Josh, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Dante, good to see you.
You're welcome.
And Bentifoia, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. You're economical with your time, and you listen to NHPR because it lets you do other things while you catch up on the news. We're economical with your time, too, and only do as much fundraising as we need to keep the programs you love going. That's why we're planning to raise our entire day's fundraising goal for day one of our March drive in just 4 hours. When we hear from 350 people, we'll cancel the drive for the rest of the day and collect $10,000 in challenge money. Your contribution now helps at nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from North Branch Construction, celebrating 56 years in business, from custom-built homes to eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, on Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. And Mill Travel American Express and their nearly 100 travel professionals, enabling New Hampshire people and businesses to buy locally and travel globally since 1975. MillTravel.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It is 10 o'clock.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Ukraine's prime minister is flying to Washington this week to meet with President Obama. The visit comes as the White House warns that Russia will face increasing international pressure if it presses ahead with a referendum to annex Crimea. Some analysts say